RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 1.
A dedication letter to John Kinmont Moyer. Dear Mr. Moyer, will you allow me the honour of dedicating to you this little volume of my life story as an expression of my appreciation of all that you have done and are trying to do for the struggling authors of this country? Among these I have a place, and shall ever be grateful for the kind and friendly interest you have shown in my efforts to contribute something to the culture of a young nation dwelling in the beams of the Southern Cross. We know something of the personal sacrifices you have made to help us, and of your gifts of time, money, and friendship, most precious in times of stress. And when the literary aspirant is suffering from the apathy of the public towards local talent, this lack of appreciation is apt to drench creative fires, and without such as you might have ended all efforts. It was then you offered words of hope and cheer, and promoted means of public attention to the work of our own writers and artists. I, for one, can never forget how you have helped me, so please let me commemorate my gratitude by this humble dedication. When you read the pages that follow, possibly you may feel that some of the people mentioned deserve a more expansive treatment. However, you will understand when I say that my intention is only to record the lives of my fellows where they touched my own, and in so doing, to suggest the influences which have moulded my career. So please accept my plain, simple, and candid story, and with it my desire that you may be long with us to carry on the good work for Australia and its seekers after culture. Tilly Aston, Melbourne. Why this story is written. Some years ago, I was honoured to number among my friends Mr. Schuller, for many years editor of The Age, and his beautiful and accomplished wife. In later years, Mrs. Schuller became blind, and the fine courage with which she faced this calamity will always be one of my most precious recollections. She was a reader and gifted with critical powers beyond the average, and often I would sit at her feet to learn good taste and judgment in matters of culture, such as literature and common philosophies, discussed among thinking people. One afternoon, when I was visiting her, the life and writing of Helen Keller came up. She asked me what I thought of the debunking element in the press directed against Miss Keller and her work, and I grew warm in the defence of the American lady, claiming that the journalists were not qualified to understand what a blind person could or could not do, because of a lack of spiritual perception, and I classed the authors of this criticism as pure and unqualified materialists. As we argued, Mr. Schuller sat listening, mostly, for he was a quiet man and interested in varying viewpoints. Suddenly Mrs. Schuller said, "Miss Aston, you can write and talk about other things. Why do you not give us your own life story?" I laughed and answered that it would be altogether too tame an affair of work and struggle to offer to the thriller-loving public, especially as I was not likely to find many readers so kind and friendly as herself. "Quite wrong," came sharply from Mr. Schuller. "The story of anyone who has made endeavour a watchword is always worth reading. You start right away, while memories are clear and fresh." This was Mr. Schuller's only word on the subject, but Mrs. Schuller was wont to round me up whenever we met. "Have you started the book yet?" To which I regularly replied, "No, not yet." Many years have passed since that first suggestion was made to me, and in recent times I have thought it might be advisable to make a record of the beginnings of both the Braille Library and the Association for the Advancement of the Blind. For the time is approaching when there will be no person living to rake over the ashes of the past where these two organizations are concerned. Then came a request from Mr. J.K. Moyer, president of the Bread and Cheese Club, that I should prepare a short sketch of my life for the Mitchell Library, where my literary works are preserved. The authorities of this institute consider it desirable to obtain authentic information about writers while they themselves can still verify it. So I complied, and in doing so, discovered such interest as to make me bold enough to hope that an extended version might serve the pleasure of some readers, and prove an inspiration to some faced with handicaps of various kinds. Therefore I begin the story, trusting that some day it may reach a friendly public through the printing press. But the Schulers were not the only people who urged me to undertake this task. Many friends, including Miss Helena McDougall, Mrs. W. Macaulay, and my cousin, Mrs. Mathy, have discussed it with me. Also Stan Brogdon and his wife, and a number of those dear blind folk who have been my loyal companions through a lifetime. But I have always felt that these people who love me were prejudiced in my favour, and still I feared the indifference of the everyday reader. Then came the sketch for the Mitchell Library, which reached the hands of Mr. W. H. Zirko of the wide-famed Business College. He read it, and offered to have it typed and bound suitably for a record library, and followed up this generosity with enthusiastic appreciation of the story and the life it described. In fact, his apparent enjoyment of the tale was so encouraging that I am setting out on the version which I plan to attain to book size. This may seem to betoken an excess of self-esteem, this record of small things and personal impressions. If so, it must be pardoned, like any other of my faults. It will be noticed that the story which follows is written in vignettes rather than in a continuous detail. In this way, I have dispensed with some of the rope and tackle gear so often used to haul to the service of memory forgotten or unimportant matters previously handled. Thus I shall try to make these pictures show but the essence of life, candor, truth, endeavor, faith, love, achievement. That those who follow me may walk through the ways which the exigencies of blindness and narrow means have forced me to travel. Early records. I was born at Carisbrook, Victoria, Australia, on the 11th of December, 1873, and claim that I am a link with the pioneering days, that period of greatest progress of our young and happy nation. My parents came as a young married couple from Gloucestershire in the year 1855, spending the first 2 years in Kapunda in South Australia. Then, at the earnest invitation of an uncle of father's, they left Adelaide by the steamer Burra Burra, landed at Sandridge in due time, and travelled on up country by bullock wagon to the small town of Carisbrook, where all our family, save the first baby girl, were born and reared. Last of the 8 children, I came upon the home scene, and each member of the family was old enough to regard me as a pet. This feeling towards me was accentuated naturally by the fact that early in my infancy it was discovered that there was some defect in my eyes. I had 2 brothers and 3 sisters still living. As the baby born in Kapunda had died soon after her arrival in Carisbrook, and a brother of 4 had been drowned in the creek some years later. Christmas, with its festive doing, was at hand when I entered this earthly scene, and I have no doubt there was the usual merrymaking. According to custom, ivy draped the doors of our dwelling and wreathed the windows and framed photographs inside. While a mistletoe bough brought in from the bush made the entrance of any of the young girls a rather exciting affair. At dinner, we feasted on goose and pork, roasted till the house reeked with the delicious odours of stuffing and gravy, and this was topped up with a rich plum pudding, to which raspberry vinegar gave a most agreeable tang. Be it remembered that our household was strictly blue ribbon, and the brandy sauce was not admitted to the fair, even on such festive occasions. Then followed an afternoon of leisure, and at tea time we tackled the ham, fruits, and thick cream, although I marvel that any of us were equal to the task. Whatever shortages or economies must restrain us during the rest of the year, Mother never allowed the jollity of Christmas to be damped for her family. Therefore, I am certain that I too was ushered into this happy turmoil, in spite of the anxiety felt about my inflamed eyes. Since that time, medical science has found a way of combating the damage to the newly born by ignorance about the eyes, and for this many bright-eyed men and women should be glad. There was another interesting event to mark the date of my birth. Up to that time, Carisbrook and other towns beyond it had been served with mails and transport by the coaches of Cobb & Co., and my brothers and sisters were familiar with the dust cloud that announced the coming of the coach over the hill, and with the rattle and roar as it swept by on the road in front of our home. But now a change was at hand. The railway had been constructed from Castlemaine, and had reached the east side of Tullaroop Creek, and was only waiting for the completion of the bridge to sweep into our little town and take its curved course right on to Maryborough. Now the contractors were men of tact and generosity, and they decided to give the children of the town a party on New Year's Day by taking them for a free ride to Castlemaine and back, the first trip in a train for most of them. Our family was represented by 5 youngsters, and all assembled on the hill, where the snorting monster was ready to haul them around the foot of Bald Hill and away to the distant goal over 30 miles away. Mother and father went to see them off on this adventure, and their last baby, obviously too young to share it otherwise, attended in mother's arms. Rolled up in a grey paisley shawl, which had enfolded more than one of our brood, so I can truthfully say that I was present on the historic occasion, even if I do not remember anything about it. However, let me go back to the purely personal once more. Our local doctor was a kindly old gentleman, a little roughened perhaps by his work as an army surgeon. To him I was carried by my father, and the verdict was anxiously awaited. Dr. Howell peered into my eyes, tested them with lights, and said that I was without sight in the right eye, and possibly would lose the other as time went on. He urged my people to see that I got all the care and training possible, that I might grow up happily in spite of the eclipse of the light, and he promised to keep an eye on me always. To my parents it was good news that I could still see a little, and they resolved that I should have as much of life's advantages as their limited means could provide. So I started out in my family, loved and guarded, with my childish talents cherished and fostered to the utmost. Father was a shoemaker, and as he sat at his bench making and mending for the feet of the community, he would fill my mind with rhymes and tables, and old Gloucestershire songs and tales. He sang well, but not so well as Mother, who included in her repertoire quite a list of ancient ballads and folk songs. I did not realize the value of these while she still remembered them, for she sang many which, as far as I can learn, have never appeared in modern collections. I learnt to sing almost before I could talk properly, and to declaim the moral songs of Isaac Watts as he held up for the edification of children the bad ways of the sluggard and the good ways of the tiny ant, not to mention those about little birds who agree in the nest, and put to shame quarrelsome sisters and brothers. As a family, we took our pleasures around the old harmonium, singing revival hymns or songs from the Christy minstrel books. And these exercises were enhanced by Father and Brother Will, both of whom played the flute. It was cheap and innocent amusement for us all. I was taught to take notice of the things about me, natural objects, astral phenomena, the calls of birds and the like. Also, I was encouraged to make simple playthings for myself, to run wild in the bush with the other children, to climb trees, to prowl and investigate the surroundings of the old mines around the town. The independence thus acquired has been one of my chief assets. Next came the time when serious education must be thought of, and they sent me to a little private school kept by the Mrs. Annie and Nellie Crooks. My sight was not good enough for much bookwork. Nevertheless, I learnt to read from giant-type books, and to write as children of my age are wont to do. I memorized poetry with ease, and I sang through my tables with utter boredom, since my dear companionable father had made them all mine long before I entered school. By degrees, change crept in. Brother Will entered the postal department and went to Melbourne for good. Amelia, my eldest sister, had qualified as a teacher in the education department and was away most of the week. Then she took a husband and went to live at Durham Ox. There I often visited her and still carry with me the memory of the wide plains and distant horizons, the north wind howling around the house, The special flowers, wild peas and everlastings, which made the life up there quite distinctive from that of Carisbrook, sitting among its ironstone hills of low altitude. Another change was coming, too. My limited vision was fading. But none of us realized this fact. On my 6th birthday, I saw the present sent up from Melbourne by Will. It was a pair of gold sleeper earrings, which I was to wear in the hope, current at the time, that piercing the ears would help the eyes. Valiantly I submitted to the piercing needle. But there was a bribe behind it, as Mother had promised me a fourpenny bit if I didn't cry. I did not forget to claim it either. That was on my 6th anniversary. On my 7th birthday, I received from Melbourne a necklace of those beautiful iridescent shells found about the south coast of Tasmania. This gift I never saw, although I wore it for years. However, I quite understood its charm, for we had among our small home treasures a box of shining shells like them, with which I had played from babyhood. I knew exactly the glory of their changing colours. So often in the course of my life, I am asked how it is I know and can describe effect of light and colour. Perhaps this one trifling incident may answer someone. It should be remembered that people who read have rarely seen objects and places pictured in poems and stories, but draw upon memories and impressions to verify a description. With myself and other blind folk, it is the same. Although we have not seen a million things we understand quite well, we have seen something else with which we can compare new impressions, something which makes it possible for us to see, perhaps more vividly than many unseeing, sighted people, the gifts of beauty or grandeur strewn around us. Thus it will be seen that my physical sight was gone before I reached the age of 7. By this time, my father had fallen into bad health and was no longer able to carry the full burden of supporting his family, although he still did what work he could. Our mother, therefore, began to accept money as a midwife, a service in the nursing line she had so often performed gratis for her neighbours. And she continued this work after my father's death, when there were still 3 of her children to be provided for. Father died in October 1881, but Mother survived him for over 30 years. To them we are indebted for much, and I pray, my reader, to bear with me still further as I offer them my loving tribute. My little shrine, dedicated to all worthy people who love their parents. It was springtime, and a day of blue skies and golden radiance, when I made one of my pilgrimages to the lowly shrine of my parents. The wide white road, with its gleaming gravel from the mines nearby, led me through shading gum trees to the gate of the cemetery, and not many paces more brought me to the spot where they sleep side by side. It was a lovely place in which to rest. Verdant grasses, sometimes invading the graves, rustled and whispered about me, as if afraid to break the hush over all. Shimmering stems of shell grass shook their trembling seeds, and decking the narrow avenues between the mounds were flowers, wild flowers. Spider orchids, scarlet runner with blossoms like rubies, billy buttons, tall of stalk and plump of bloom, daisy peas, and wild geranium, the beautiful darlings of the bushlands around Carisbrook. I remember how, as children, we loved this place. Here, where the cattle browsed not, nature had full scope for her glories. In those days, the lurking snake and scuttling lizard had few terrors for us, and we gathered our springtime garlands in this garden of peace. Here, then, among the flowers, and not far from the guardian eucalypts at the farther end of the burying ground, my father and mother lie waiting for eternity. They were a humble pair. Both were born in Gloucestershire, one at 5 acres and the other at Lane End, and simple as the names of their birthplaces were, the life they led. They loved and were married in England, and a few weeks later set sail for this land of hope and youth. Their ship, the John Banks, set them down in Adelaide after a voyage of 4 months. They remained in South Australia for 2 years, and their first child, a daughter, was born and named Eliza. Then the gold fever seized them, and in addition came an invitation from an uncle of father's who had settled at Carisbrook in Victoria. So they took their passage by the steamer Burra Burra and landed at Sandridge with the baby and all their possessions. But still more than 100 miles must be traversed to get to the country town, and this was done by bullock wagon, a truly terrible experience for the young mother, as her little one, about a year old, was ill. The jolting over the rough track made travel in the wagon impossible for the frail infant, so taking it turn about, the parents walked all the journey, carrying the little sufferer in their arms. In due time they arrived at the orchard, where they stayed for a few months. But the babe did not survive, and her death was the first real sorrow which the young couple faced together. Soon, however, came another child to comfort them, my eldest sister Charlotte Amelia. After a period of life in a tent, they made a home and settled in the little town, and father plied his trade as a bootmaker and planted a garden about his house. 6 other children were born there: William, George, Sophia, Stephen, another Eliza, and myself, Matilda Ann. My brother George had perished in the creek nearby, but he had come and gone before my time. In the Wesleyan chapel opposite our home, we learned to know God and to follow in the paths of rectitude the two who rest in this garden of sleep. I knelt on the curb which marks off their grave and thought about them and their struggles. We brought father here when I was 8, and mother 31 years later. What did I owe them? They had never gathered wealth. They had not the money-gathering talent. Perhaps they were a little too frank, somewhat overcautious, as aiming at material gain calls for great restraint in dealing with the weaknesses of others, and it also demands a willingness to take risks. But our parents left us some things that were more precious than money. First, by wise use of their small means, we were helped to sound healthy bodies by good food, comfortable clothing, and a judicious use of recreation. Sometimes, as children, we envied our neighbours who wore finer feathers, or frolicked at the fortnightly quadrille parties. But maturer knowledge has revealed our actual gains. For good health, therefore, we thank our parents. Having little book learning, they were nevertheless astute and endowed with wisdom. They knew that advancing time would require advances in education, so they strove and toiled and planned to give their children the utmost advantage in this sphere, and for this too I lift up a thankful heart now, as I did beside their grave. But the most precious legacy was something outside the material realm, and quite incalculable in words and figures. It was that sense of justice, truth, and honesty which is the foundation of all human relations. A promise, whether by pen or word, must be inviolable. There were no white lies, only one sort, lies. Truth must be spoken or lived out at whatever cost. To cheat, to steal, to trick, or in any way defraud another was dishonesty. Father had a mind full of maxims and lived up to them. His standard of honesty was this: it is a sin to steal a pin. It was in this rigid school that we were reared. To what extent the modern laxities have whittled down the bars is not easy for me to judge, but this was the grand and glorious heritage to which I and my brothers and sisters were heirs. It was not only the moral law which they gave us. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, they taught. So we learned reverence, obedience, charity, and love. We were not allowed to forsake church and Sunday school while we were with our parents. We were expected to fall in with their religious principles. Some say this is a tyranny. Well, thank God for our tyrants, at least. We dared not drift when we were too weak to steer ourselves, and when we were old enough, we had no desire to do so. Thus, for my spiritual foundations, I honour my parents' memory. Who will blame me that I bent and rested my face upon the earth which covered them, and lifted up to God a grateful heart, because I had once known the love and sound guidance of 2 such splendid people? As the world classes them, they were nobodies. Father, a humble tradesman, mother, a simple, untaught, rustic girl, who learned to read at Sunday school, and never penned a line until chance took her lover away to a distant town for a time, when she mastered the art of writing so as to be able to write her own thoughts to him without the intervention of an outsider. This is their record, just plain Edward and Anne Aston, but to me, my father and mother.
That brings us to the end of episode 1 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.